Part two of the tips and tricks session. I wanted to be there for Yanni's talk yesterday. In fact, What? Did you miss the first part?
No, I was here.
All right, I don't understand the question. Does it matter?
No.
Okay, I wanted to be here yesterday, but when finally it was decided that he would give the talk, I couldn't drive back in time safely, so I missed it. However, there is a tape, so I will look at it. So this part is about giving talks. Again, this has been deemed very useful by PhD students in my home institution, and I'm happy to share that with you. It's very person-oriented, so like it's talking about you. So you have to give a talk. And that talk can be a scientific one, at a seminar, at a retreat, at a conference. It can be an interview as a postdoc or for a job. And it can be something else. You can pass an oral exam. You can have a PhD defense. You can teach to students. You may have an administrative meeting where you're going to report something. Or in Denmark, typically people will talk at lunches or dinners about the bride or something. All of these things have one thing in common, which is you, all right? So you are the speaker, you have an audience, and you want to transmit an information. To that end, you use a medium, which is your voice, your body language, any kind of computing facilities, a board, a blackboard, whatever, and occasionally slides. Now, what's specific about the information that you are transmitting from the speaker to the audience is the nature of the information. And that information can be new or it can be known. Okay, so think of an oral exam. When you pass an exam, the kind of information that you want to convey is that you know the material. And you can be sure that the person who gives you the oral exam knows already the material. And his job is to check that you do it too. When you give a research talk, it's the other way around. The audience does not know what you're talking about, but you do. And your job is to transmit it. Okay? So in Latin, you call that distinguo. You need to distinguish situations. And whenever you give a talk, it's good to assess what kind of information you want to give. Is it new or is it known? In the kind of talks that we are interested in here, the new information can be a scientific talk, in which case nobody else but you knows the information. It can also be true for teaching, where the new students do not know the material. And at an administrative meeting where you report the progress on blah, 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 the gardening of the company or whatever, it's all new to the audience, okay? So there is information and there is meta-information. In an interview talk, you just don't want to talk about like your thesis. You want to express that you would be a great guy to hire. That's a lot of meta-information. And the kind of things that people will think while giving your interview talk or talking with you is something as basic as, would I like to have lunch with that guy every day for the next 5 years? Okay, which you probably didn't think about when you come to give the interview. Now, the thing is that it also works the other way around. Would you be happy to have lunch with these guys every day for the next years? So the meta-information you want to convey is that not only you know what you're talking about, but you would thrive in the place, you would progress, you would actually be a good guy to hire. So in all of this taken into account, when you want to transmit information from the guy who is giving the talk to the audience, you want to maximize that throughput. You want to give a good talk. And you want to do that for two reasons. One, you want to do justice to your topic. You want, if it's interesting, you want to convey that it is interesting. You want to change the world. And conversely, in a more modest way, you do not want to waste the brain cycles of your audience. You're talking to people who collectively are vastly more intelligent than you, and you don't want them to lose their time. So I will take it chronologically. Before the talk. So the assumption is that you have something to say. All right, and when you see stand-up comedians, when they start, it's an art that it looks like they don't know what they are going to say, and then they manage anyway. Like think of Victor Borge, the Danish comedian, or one-man show. He specialized into that. Woody Allen does that too. Both of them know what they are doing. So in your case, I assume that you have a message. Can be a thesis, all right? In your PhD defense, after you build up the case, you could say, and it is my thesis that, and then you state your thesis. And then the rest of the talk is to defend it. All right, so that's something that you want to say, or it could be a refutation. It is commonly thought that, well, no, and here is why. Or it could be a theorem. My widening operator is sound, or a corollary, because I use constraints. My narrowing operator is sound. Okay. It could be an idea. Hey, life would be so much easier if we used continuations. Okay. It could be a report. I'm here to report to you about the progress on implementing the new version of the compiler. Or it could be a tutorial when you want to survey an area and then let people know. So because you give talk which are time constrained, you need to what is called think backwards. And what do you want people to remember from your talk? So I'm giving you a counterexample here because I'm bombarding you with concepts. And the slides are on my page. I want to awake you to the fact that some things are necessary or start you to think about it, especially if you disagree. But when you give a talk, you need to do like Michelangelo with his hammer and the stone. You need to remove everything which is extraneous. And think, what do you want people to remember from your talk? And so often, that means that you take your killer app, and that's going to be the arc of your talk, and everything else should just support that so that people can say, wow, that was the talk about blah. That was so cool. That means that you have to kill your darlings, as I said last time, and you cannot say everything. You need to simplify, as Einstein used to like to say. In science, things should be simple. You should bring things to be simpler, but not more than that. In other words, it should be simple, not simplistic. And then there is the cohort of psychologists who arrive and say, anyway, people can remember at most 5 things from your talk. So. Keep it simple.
Is simplifying the key to making someone else want to have lunch with you?
People will be grateful if you can cut down a talk to its essence. And not to say, well, oh, you want me to tell you about my thesis? Well, first I need to tell you about what's a computer on. Believe me, it's not Windows. It's like the joke of the guy who is on his sofa in the psychoanalyst office, and the psychoanalyst says, okay, tell me all your problems since the beginning. And the guy starts, well, I was born on. Right? So that's an example of, well, the analyst is perhaps happy because he will have a lot of time, he will clock a lot of time with that patient, but simplifying is the essence. Can you, in 20 minutes, make a point that will be informative? That's the challenge. And just to tell you that, whenever I turn a talk by students in my institution, they usually have to rewrite their talk. But then it's a better talk, and that's other people who say that, not me. Okay, so anyway, rules are made to be broken. Do not become the slave of a talk. Or of the rules. So you may completely break the rules to make them work for you. Okay, so some jazz players, for example, are accomplished classical pianists. You can always recognize a self-taught pianist. So example, in ESOP 2000 and something, I was to give a talk on implementing continuations, I think it was. What else could it be? And I did not have my front slide that says title, author, institution, date, place. I just started with the talk. And so when I arrived to give the talk, the session chair said, "Hey, forgot your first slide." And I let it be. And then I just started the talk. And it started by saying, well, we want to do that, but there is this problem. So we could do this, but there is this problem. Ah, we could do that. Well, okay, so three problems. Well, I'm here to tell you about solving all these problems at once. And shpunk, there was the title of the talk and my name and blah, blah, blah. And if that reminds you of the beginning of Raiders of the Lost Ark, the Indiana Jones, that's exactly the inspiration. You suddenly stop, so I stopped. I didn't start the movie by, well, Indiana Jones didn't start the movie with a title. He just put the audience immediately in the movie and then announced the title. Okay, so I did it, find something else. But find what works for you. At any rate, on the uppermost, you should be aware of which message you want to send and what you want your audience to remember. And so you have to just make at least one point, but make it comprehensively, because you cannot make all your points. So before the talk, now we assume that you know what you want to say. And now I will talk about how you can say it. And basically, you should take all the help you can round up, and there are usually slides. You may want to make a demo about your system. It's a dangerous idea, because your fingers will slip, you will mistype something, and something will go wrong. So it's much better to have a passive demo. It's also what?
Convincing,
okay. Yes, so I'll give you two examples about that. One is Eric Meyer at Purple a few years ago, shortly after he joined Microsoft. And then he arrived at the end of a whole day at Microsoft. You're tired now, okay? So everybody was exhausted. And everybody was just talking and blah, 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 and not really paying attention. And then he said, okay, I'll show you a movie. Ah, boom, the movie started. And now there is that kind of reflex that, a movie, that's nice. We can all relax and watch the movie. And he had everybody's attention. That was impressive. So that kind of things work. The interactive demo is dangerous, and I'll give you an example. So at the turn of the 90s, I spent a summer at Xerox PARC, which was a hotbed of inventing a lot of everything cool, basically. Now, on the other side of the road, more or less, there is the Hewlett-Packard Research Labs, in which there are lots of people who left Xerox PARC or whatever, but who are making money out of great ideas that have been developed at Xerox PARC. Be it as it may, they kind of look at each other and they don't really like each other. So there is an engineer of Hewlett-Packard who arrives, and then he's giving a talk, and he's going to show the great software tools that Hewlett-Packard is going to give to everybody. So there is a movie, and okay. And the whole thing is just geared not to work. The guy, so he's talking to engineers, I mean, guys who develop with t-shirts, sweaters, I mean, sneakers, hands-on guys, ponytails. And the guy arrives, and he's clear-cut hair, and he has a tie. Okay, that's half of it. The other half of it is that he has a secretary behind a table who is typing what he wants to what he tells her to type, and that's shown on the screen. So at that point, the guy has no respect whatsoever from the hands-on kind of hackers who are at Xerox PARC. And so he tells her what to do and this and that. And then she probably mistyped something because flashes out of on the screen a really large window that says, unexpected error in blah, 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 blah. Do you want to enter the debugger? Yes or no? And this is perhaps in my life the part where I have been the closest to a crowd of, you know, 300 perhaps, and we all yelled, yes! And of course, we wanted to enter into the debugger and what was below the hood. And whereas the guy didn't want us to know that. And physically, he was hit like by a wave by our collective, yes! And then he snapped at the secretary, no! So dutifully, she clicked on no, and the demo continued. Interactive demos are risky, okay? Movies are better, safer, okay? I'm just saying safer, not better. Break the rules, but at your own risk. So a talk is typically atomized in a bunch of slides, and the point of the slides is that they support and guide your talk. And so you should try to surf on your slides, not fight with them. The slides are the thing that if you go astray or if you're lost or if you forgot completely what to say, then you just go to the next slide and then you continue. Trying to cooperate with your slides means don't try to say more than was on the slides and keep the pace that the slides tell you to keep. So, upfront, the non-goal, don't start editing your slides. If you do that, you will induce an atomic and a linear view, your nose will be on your screens and you will have no global view, and you will be instantly diving into irrelevant formatting concerns, which is a typical stress situation. We can't do everything big, but at least we can do small things. And then you just have spent lots of time formatting something that will not be in the final version. So don't start editing the slides. Don't open up your editor or your formatter or whatever. Instead, do a comic strip. You take a pen, so, and an eraser, and a piece of paper, and then you draw a comic strip. Okay, and I remember once telling that to a bunch of people, and I have been told afterwards, we had so much fun writing in PostScript something so that we could actually write the comic strip and then we could fill it up. Lovely. So no computer, just you, a pencil, and an eraser. And then you write a comic strip, you know, a tape, horizontal or vertical. And then you have one picture per slide. And then that gives you an overview of your talk. In one or two, on two pages, you see your whole talk right in front of you. Plus, you can't write too much on each slide. It's so easy to write too much on one slide, and then people don't have the time to look at them. So how many slides per minute can you do with that? It completely depends on you. So having make that comic strip, well, what do you put in this comic strip? So you don't plan as you play Lego by just assembling things. The planning reflects the current state of your understanding, and so you will not give the same talk to in 6 months as you do today. And so you should not plan your talk in the chronological order that you carried out the experiment. Nobody cares about that. Imagine a speaker who arrives and say, well, first we tried this, but you know it didn't work. Then we thought, well, maybe we should try that. Well, that didn't work either. And then the audience is thinking, what do we care? What we want is how does what he proposed solves the problem. So chronological order is out. I'm sorry?
Can we go back to
Sure.
Sometimes it's actually something I'm simulating, because usually ideas which might have worked and then are not reported into the, and especially in an engineering context.
Yes, I completely agree. For years, I've wanted to start a journal called the Journal of Failures, the journal of things that don't work, exactly so that people would have a honorable forum to explain what things that look good but actually don't work. At this point of time, these kind of things are replaced, kept into drawers, and whenever you or I think we have a good idea, write preliminary work, submit it to PLDI, there is the referees who take their drawer and then hit us on the head with all the things that don't work. It would be really nice if we could know what doesn't work and why. Would it be only because we could actually show that does work, perhaps, if you use continuations, for example? Okay, so the point is that you're writing a talk, you're giving a talk, and you have one message to give. Maybe your message is what doesn't work and why, But then that would be your point. Okay? So you can't say it in the order because you don't have the time. Now, in your paper, you probably have chosen a logical order, which is maybe it includes the backtracking. But here, no chronology, nothing logical, but something pedagogical. It has to be adapted to the presentation, adapted to the audience, adapted to the duration, etc. So, assume that you know what to do, what to say. You have assembled your slides, you wrote your comic strip, you edited your slides, and you're ready to give your talk. So what happens right before the talk? An advice of John Reynolds, which he applies to himself, is to give the talk to yourself just before giving just before the talk, and then you're kind of in it, and it's a very easy way for it to come out of you. Now, assuming that you're talking in a conference, you contact the session chairperson so that he knows you. You agree about the length of the talk, and the signals. He's going to flag his hand. For example, last week at DSL, they failed to agree on the signal, and then the session chair just did blah, and the speaker said, yes, you have a question, and he said, no, 5 minutes. So that's an example of miscommunication. All right, so now you have agreed with everything with the session chair, and so what you should do is to be comfortably dressed, you should be comfortable. You should breathe deeply because that's what oxygenates your brain, and you are going to use your brain a lot, and do not drink a carbonated beverage for the reason that I was mentioning the other day. The air tends to come out in the most unpleasant way and at most unpleasant time. So like the main guy in your PhD committee is asking you something, and then you're trying very hard not to burp, not a good idea. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about the talk, and it's all centered on you, the speaker, and how to handle the slides, and I will mention what can go wrong, because things will go wrong. Okay, so you're about to start the talk. It's always a good idea to straighten up, just gives more air in your lungs, to face the audience. Think of all the times where that math professor arrived, didn't look at you, arrived at the blackboard and write, let X be, and then you were started. How did that work for you? I mean, not well, because otherwise you would not be here doing computer science. You would be out there doing math. Okay, it's always a good idea to smile and express that you're happy to be here. It just warms up the audience, and they are there. More receptive. You should actually dare to speak slowly and loudly, and you really have to dare that. It's really difficult. And then the clinch is that in the end, by giving a talk, you actually express who you are, which is why shy people have such a hard time giving a talk, because they want to hide. All right, so concentrating on how to say it, well, speak slowly and loudly. Speak for the others, not for yourself. And there is no need to force your voice. So a very superficial study has shown that male speakers will feel uncomfortable, so they will try to inspire confidence. Okay, I'm in charge here. Okay, and females will tend to speak higher to just beg for mercy. Don't hurt me, I'm cute. Okay, so in between these two things, you should just be balanced. And don't let your tone fall down. I've seen a talk, which I still remember to this day, and every single sentence started like this and then finished like that. And then the next sentence started very high and then finished like that. And after 5 minutes, so this is really gloomy. So now, conversely, people who don't breathe enough will typically finish their sentence like that. And it's really difficult. I remember at an oral exam seeing a student who was physically not breathing. And he was turning pale. And I thought, this guy is going to faint in 5 minutes. And so I called for a recess. So I said, stop. And I got up from my chair and I told him, so this is a context where I was giving half an hour oral exam for the whole day, for a whole week. And that was at the end of the day. And then I told the students that I needed some exercise and to breathe, and he needed to. And so he should. And then I showed him that he should breathe in, breathe out, breathe in. And I told him he should do that 5 times before continuing his talk. So he did a little bit like a cormorant. He wasn't breathing. But after a while, he forgot himself. I was looking stupid enough that he could forget about himself. And then we had a very nice talk, and he got a very good grade. So the tone jumping up shows that you don't breathe enough. All right, what's UpTalk? I know because I've asked a linguist from Harvard. So there is this Americanism where you cannot speak like that, and then you keep going, and then you, so it's called UpTalk technically. It's teenagers talking to each other, and they don't want to make a mess, so they, you see what I mean? So you would say, so you should be balanced because you should not let your tone fall down or jump up. That's UpTalk. And there is a thesis about it. And bottom line, it sounds terribly tentative. It's teenager speak where you don't want to offend anybody. If someone doesn't agree, you're ready to backtrack. And this is the moment to be definite when you give your talk. So avoid UpTalk. And finally, bottom line, don't be afraid. You're one among many others. That's what's written on the coins of 1 cent in the US. One among many others. You're one speaker among many others. And the last case of cannibalism of the audience to the speaker is unknown. So you're safe. Example, July 1909. Louis Blériot, the French air pilot, crosses the English Channel by plane. And I just read in the newspaper that 1 century later, which is this month, there is a guy who has done the same on a copy of that plane. So it was a first. He went from France to the UK. And afterwards, a journalist asked him, so how did you feel about it? Weren't you worried about the sharks or falling? And he answered, no, I was not worrying about the waves below. I was watching my engine. And that's what you should do when you give your talk. Just watch your engine, and then the talk will take care of itself. Okay, so now you have to conduct the talk. First thing, you put the front slide, whatever there is on it. The second thing, you get installed with a microphone and so on. Now you're all male for a change. So it's kind of a male thing between the session chair and you, if he's a he. You kind of arrive in front of him, you stand up like that, he gives you the microphone, you look each other in the eyes, yes, signal, 5 minutes, okay. It doesn't really work like that if the speaker is female, because usually the chair doesn't want to go and put the microphone on her chest, and vice versa. So, but that's not a problem for you. The next thing is to try your voice, right? When you want to give your talk, you it's going to be hard to come out. And then you start your talk proper, okay? So last year at ECOOP, there was one of the invited speakers who started his talk as follows. He was late, 24 hours, and then he explained why he was late. And he was late because in the plane, he was seated next to the exit row, and then there is the stewardess who arrived and says, so are you gentlemen ready to open the door in case of emergency? And there is someone who says, oh yeah, sure! And he got up and opened the door. So they couldn't fly. They all had to be deplaned and the whole thing had to be. So he was late. So that's called a valid excuse, okay? And so that kind of things get your audience started. Anyway, trying your voice, this is the first thing you need to do. So don't say, can everybody hear me? Because I'll be at the end of the audience and I will say, no! Everybody will laugh at you and it's a bad idea. So if you start with, this is joint work with X, your PhD advisor, typically, that's good. If you say this work was carried out in, okay, and in your lab, that's excellent. Briggs being where I used to be. Now, if you give a seminar, you should thank your host. And if you're happy to be here, you should say so. It's great to be here. I always have whatever. You'll know what you feel. All right, now you need to start the talk. And the first thing you need to establish is, what are your credentials? Who is that guy? And I mean, what does he know? Why should we care about what he says? So you kind of have to establish your credentials. And technically, you just have to use some keywords that show that you talk what you're talking about. You know what you're talking about. The second point is not new. It dates from Cicero in the Antiquity. And it's called to captate the goodwill of the audience. So people will they were willing to spend 20 minutes talking. Yes?
What credentials could we say for a beginning graduate student?
I'm interested in blah. And I have found that problem, which I think is interesting. And that's enough to get you started. What's a non-starter is, I didn't quite know what to do, but my PhD advisor told me to look at that, so I'm going to tell you about it. You see? So that's the credentials. In the end, people want to have a speaker who is interested in this topic. OK? One way is to establish the common points with the audience. And that always works. So here is a story. That's a guy who when he was a teenager, formative years of his life, he was caught in a big flood. A big flood, okay? So he had to climb on top of his house and then he had to swim on a piece of wood that was passing by, and he saved someone, okay, big story. And he survived. And then that was really the adventure of his life, so he liked to tell it to people. Okay, by the end of his life, he's not a very mobile person, everybody of his entourage has known the story, so he hasn't told it for a long time. He dies. He meets St. Peter, or whomever you like. And St. Peter asks him, well, can I do something for you? And he said, well, yes. I have had that great story about the flood. I haven't been able to tell it for anyone for 20 years. I would love to tell my story of a flood. So St. Peter says, well, sure, I'll see what I can do. He checks around, comes back and says, actually, yes, everybody is interested. I have reserved the auditorium tomorrow at 10 o'clock. So the guy's really happy. He comes to the auditorium, and just before he starts, there is the St. Peter who tells you, there's just one thing you need to know. Noah is in the audience. Okay, so Noah, that's the flood, okay, in the Bible. So the common points with the audience, they can be positive and they can be negative. You may have world specialists in the audience. You may have people who know nothing about what you want to say. You have to find a common ground. And this is where you are going to build your talk. Okay, it's useful to use a roadmap. So that's an annotated plan of the talk so that people see where you are, where you want to go. You should remember every time to say, that kind of things. It's obvious. When you give a talk at a conference, you have 20, 25 minutes. You have one point to make. And your goal is that you want people to read your paper. If some people have read your paper, you want them to appreciate one specific thing. And this is your chance. And if your paper has several points, you can only make one of them. So kill your darlings. If you give a talk at a seminar that's in a university, in a research group typically, it's longer, but the time is still limited, 45, 60 minutes. And then there is something that you need to realize, and this matters. What is the nature of the questions you are going to have? And in an interview talk, it's not going to be your contribution which is going to be questioned. It's going to be your assumptions. And everybody comes flat-footed about that. You never realize that you're being questioned your assumptions. Example. There you are saying, I want to tell you about my garbage collector for a functional language. And it's really nice, semi-space, shiny algorithm, blah, 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 weak pointers, low asymptote, okay, the works. And then there is a guy in the background who says, I think that functional languages are a really bad idea. And then you say, yes, but my garbage collector is, well, yeah, but that's not the point. If functional language don't matter, garbage collection doesn't matter either. So, okay, and that guy's questioning your assumptions. So whenever you're being asked a question, have your little demon in your background of your mind that says, am I being questioned about my assumptions? Or am I being questioned about my contributions? And then answer. Now that risk skyrockets if you are going for an interview talk or at top places. So I've met it in MIT, CMU, Bell Labs.
Well, you first identify the question.
You repeat the question and then you qualify it. Aha, this question is a really basic one. It's not about what I have done, it's about, and then you're in control. They also test you to see whether you can trip. Yes, Ilya?
Oh, thank
you. So when you give a talk to a seminar, you should be well prepared. You should be very clear about your goal. And if someone is trying to take over your talk, you should just not hesitate to say, this is not the point, or just give me a chance. In the US, these two sentences work. So use it. And then there is, it's great that Patrick is here because he's quoted there. So there is a talk at a seminar followed by a discussion. And I know personally of two such places, ENS in Paris with Patrick and Northeastern University with Mitch Wand. And then what happens is that you have your talk, 60 minutes, followed by 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 hours of discussion. Okay, and now you can be sure that you are going to talk about your topic in depth with people who are hugely smart. So you should be very well prepared. And you should be ready both to have fun and to learn new things. This is a case where you're not just going to say things, you're going to learn them as well. And often that can lead to a joint paper. So to end your talk, announcing the ending is good, like a slide entitled conclusion. And then like in your paper, you can summarize the background and thus the significance of the work. There was this that was necessary, it matters because we have presented blah, especially in your PhD defense, and then you open perspective by saying, from here we can go here or there. Then you can say, thank you, are there any questions, or you let the chairperson take over. Okay, so it was from the beginning to the end. And I will say it again, what is the finality of your talk? Is it the message or is it the messenger? Is it more important that the message went through or that it was you who were delivering it? And ask yourself that question first and answer it, because you're not going to give the same talk. Now, a few don'ts. Don't overestimate your audience. Gosh, they know everything. Noah is in the audience. Well, you have spent more time thinking, at least recently, about your problem than most people in the audience. Conversely, do not underestimate your audience. There is always the risk that there is a world specialist in the audience who is ready to ask you questions. Don't underestimate yourself. You have worked on that problem. You have done lots of things. Trust your supervisor. You are well prepared. Conversely, do prepare the talk well. All right. There is an American tradition of starting a talk by cracking a joke. It's double-edged. It can be very, very distracting. So unless you can find a joke that fuels people towards what you want to say, beware. On the other hand, maybe your audience is completely asleep and then you want to say something. Example, when Google was opening its research center in Aarhus, which is where they developed the V8 JavaScript engine, there was a totally brilliant talk given by a guy from MIT. And then there was a guy from Bell Labs who followed up, and he started by saying, there is no way I can follow that. That guy has given a totally great talk. I can't do that. So I'll show you my favorite scene from Bruce Willis, Lethal Weapon 4, no, not Lethal Weapon, Die Hard, thank you, where Bruce Willis shoots down an helicopter with his car. And then everyone says, a movie! And then they watch it for 30 seconds. And by the end of the 30 seconds, their standards had been lowered. And then he was ready to enter. And okay, so that was a trick. Okay, and so how do you start a talk with an audience who is tired or hungry or anything? You have to find something. I mean, I could tell you my own things, but find yours. All right, things to try to avoid: the long visual pauses, especially on a blank screen. The sound effects are usually either too loud or not loud enough and distracting anyway. And the other thing to avoid is slides that are displayed too quickly because the audience still tries to read them, and that's very frustrating. For your PhD defense, of course you will print out all of your slides and give them to your program committee, PhD committee, so that they can write notes on the side. Yes?
If you can't think of anything to say.
That's a good point. Do you have a Mac? A computer?
Yeah.
So there is a really brilliant thing in the Mac to give talks where you can see on one part what's on the screen, and then you have a bunch of things that the rest of the screen is used for your own notes. And if you do not know what to say in the preparation of the talk, you have put the first sentence to say. When I was a younger speaker, I got blocked like that. So I always put a little folder on my slides, as you know, slides, not computers, in which there was the first sentence for each slide, and that got me through. So if you have that problem, have a first sentence ready for each slide, and then there will be no problem. All right, well, you can't correct slide on the fly nowadays. Making self-comments is only for the masters, okay? Otherwise, it's completely distracting. I was back at giving the oral exams for half an hour for a long time. And then the way it works is that we used to give questions, and then the students would pick one of the known questions, and then say which question is going to answer. And there was one particular student who said, "Oh, I knew that you would be asking me that question." And then I thought, well, good, because he knows how to answer it. No, he didn't. So that's an example of a self-comment which is distracting. So, forgot to fix that. Oh, I did it again. Oh, I'm running out of time. All things that are distracting, because they take away the attention from the message to the messenger. On the other hand, all rules are made to be broken. And Patrick today made hilarious self-comments. And here it's LaTeX, which is broken. And everybody laughed and understood what he meant. So this is brilliantly made. But he's a pro. You're not a pro yet. All right, another thing is to put your hand on your mouth while you are speaking. So we are monkeys, all right? We like touching, okay? So we're in a stress situation, and then, okay, and I've seen it happen, and the insecure speaker just did that, and then he stayed like that more or less for the rest of the talk, and he was touching himself, he was touching his nose, a little touch, the human touch, and the terrible thing is that the next speaker started to do the same, so not bad idea. Another example is any kind of okay, which are horrible. So a small story about that. A few years ago, I was giving a previous version of that talk in a summer school, and I just forgot to mention that. And I was thinking overnight, that's stupid, because it's such a useful thing to be aware of. The next morning, there is a speaker who arrives, and he's a cool guy. He just comes to give his talk, and then he leaves. And the whole half of the talk was, And I thought, oh, goodness, lucky that I did not mention that. Otherwise, the whole audience would be in tears of laughter, and he would not know why. So if your audience starts to laugh, That's extremely uncomfortable because you wonder why. So be in control. Just introduce yourself a few things that will make the audience laugh so that you control them. I don't know, instead of writing denotational semantics, I used to write detonational semantics in one corner of the slides, and a few people got it and they laughed, and that kept them under control. All right, and then finally try to avoid overdoing anything. Not too many colors, not too many fonts, not too much background, not too many animations, and so on. All right, so what happens if you just don't run out of things to say, but you run out of slides? Well, that's not a disaster. Short talks are always appreciated. So you should conclude in an unhurried way and summarize the main point of the talk. You should not repeat the talk, which is what a common temptation, and then finish, and people will like you for that. You should, of course, not make a personal comment. Ah, blast, I run out of time again. I knew I should have added more slides, all things that are distracting and not the point. What happens if you run out of time? Well, the golden rule is that you should conclude properly. So you should finish your point as quickly as you can. Say, for the rest of you, you can read the paper, I'll conclude now. And then jump to the conclusion and conclude properly. So now you have given your talk and handed back the microphone, so to speak, to the session chair. And now people are going to ask you questions. And so I will tell you about how to do to handle questions and what to do if there are no questions, which happens. All right, this is important. Always repeat the question. Okay, don't rush answering it. And there are lots of reasons for that. One of them is that you ask me a question, I start to answer. Nobody else has heard your question. And so there will be always someone who say, what was the question? Or can you repeat the question? Or disturbing things. So repeat the question for everybody else. Repeat the question for yourself. It gives you time to think about it and to identify what kind of question is it. If it's a technical question, you give it a technical answer. If it's a friendly question, all right. I have been asking about 8 questions in this summer school. Each of them was a friendly question. Each of them could have been grabbed by the speaker and being used to make his point even better. And I'm sorry to say that none of the speakers grabbed that opportunity to make that point. Instead, they all dismissed. So don't do that. I mean, they are friendly questions. You can use them to make your talk even better. And then finally, the kind of question, challenging questions, then you have to be upfront. Okay, so always repeat the question, all right? If you pass an exam, make sure that all the terms of the questions are defined. Because if they are not, then you will start to answer without having defined anything, and then you'll have to backtrack, and it's going to be a mess. Okay? Making sure all the terms are defined is a good way to answer the question. Plus, Kostas yesterday asked me, so I was 2 days ago, asked me a question, okay? And the question was about what happens about your own related work. This is a very weird question in the context until I realized that, oh, what he means is, what about blind review, double blind reviews? Because then related work become a problem. But if you put your name on the author, there is no problem about related work. Okay, and that's a completely common point with PhD students at the beginning. And one day, if you have children, you'll see it's the same with children. They never ask you what they mean. And it's your role to actually spell it out for them and then see whether they can answer the question themselves in the first place. Well, it's the same with an excited guy who is going to be in your PhD committee. He's going to go and blurb out a big question, which goes anywhere, and in the end he says, oh, what do you think? And then it really looks great if you can summarize what he has said in a really crisp way and then give a brilliant answer. Okay? So when people ask you questions, it's very often that the question is incomplete or is not asking what they mean. And you score points every time that you state the question, capturing what they mean. So one golden rule, repeat the question in order to understand it and to make sure that everybody understands the question so that you're on the same page, and then you answer. All right, example question number one. You have been using induction. And the smart person in the audience says, wouldn't have been simpler to use co-induction. So you say, the question is, wouldn't it have been simpler to use co-induction? That's a very good point. No, I tried. And it's actually simpler to use induction. Next question. Okay? So that's, you have scored there. Version two. The question is, wouldn't it have been simpler to use co-induction? That's a very good point. Perhaps I will look at it. Thank you. Okay, in both cases you win. Version number one is better. Example question number two. Wasn't this known already? The question was, wasn't this known already? Well, to the best of my knowledge, no, it was not known already. Right, so this is a little bit dangerous. Now, I'm going to tell you something. Don't do it, but if you need, do it. No, it was not already. And you know, my PhD advisor, he checked it out, and he told me that it was not. In fact, all the program committee members who accepted the paper, nobody told me that. So no, I don't think it was known already. Do you think it was known already? Okay, so now you're covered, all right? It was an advice from a guy who was on my PhD committee that whenever someone asks you, wants to slap you, what you should do is to press on the cheek of someone else to receive the slap. All right. Isn't your main theorem a corollary of Erdős' theorem? Erdős is a mathematician who wrote thousands of theorems. The question is, isn't my main theorem a corollary of Erdős' theorem? That's a good question. Which theorem do you have in mind? Okay, so if there is something you don't know, just bounce back. Don't say, I don't know. All things that are bad. All right, and then there is the famous question of the guy who just runs. And usually, if it's in a conference, and you will see them, there are guys who are a little bit aged, and they haven't been publishing at the conference, but they still come. And then they don't really have questions, so they start with, more than a question, I would like to make a comment. And then he goes for 10 minutes, and so that, you know, hey, I'm still here. And then what you have to do is listen to it very, very seriously, because he probably has a point. And then you should say, the question, I believe, is, and then you give something much smaller, and then you look at him, yes, that's what I meant, and then you give the brilliant answer, okay? So you really have to take the time to listen to it, and then see what he wants to say, and then give an appropriate answer in all respect. All right. Often there is a Dutch in the audience, and Dutch have an extremely aggressive tradition in academia, and they are extremely confrontational, and there's nothing personal about it. It's a known fact that when they go for their PhD defense, they really mean defense. They hire a guard with a spear, ready to defend you. So you may have a Dutch in the audience who just attacks you full-front with, you're destroyed. So at that point, you just, you know, it rains. You wait before the end of the rain, and then you say, I'm sorry, what was your question? Okay, not insolently like that, but, you know, don't take it on stride. It's usually pointless to say, well, you too! Or, I read your previous paper, and it was worse! Or whatever. But you're not here for that, okay? Okay, so the more than a question, I would like to make a comment, I already told you. And make sure that whenever you ask a question, all the terms of the question are defined. And this matters. When you speak, and you're not a native speaker, make sure, be very careful about the idioms that you use, because they usually don't mean what you think you mean. I was told by someone I respect a lot not to swear or in a language in which I hadn't been living in the country for 4 years. And of course, I don't have any reasons of swearing, but you know. So all the things that, again, Sylvester Stallone or Arnold Schwarzenegger says in these big action movies that are so much fun, that is not for you. It means something else. So don't use slang. The Princess Bride, a must-see, has a hilarious scene where there is a guy who says inconceivable every like 15 seconds for 5 minutes. And at one point, there is someone who tells him, I don't think this word means what you think it means. So be aware of that. All right, I told you about the ET. What's ET short for? Whenever someone asks you what is X, do not start with X, it's when, and then da da da. Okay, it raises a flag in the mind of the audience as model thinking and grammatically unsound person. At the oral exam, of course, do not say, I knew you would ask these questions, because if it were the truth, you would have prepared the answer. All right, this is a quote from the Big Lebowski, which I thought was cute. So Professor Lebowski is in your program, in your PhD committee. It's only funny if you have seen the Big Lebowski. And he asks you, what is your contribution exactly? And then you answer, all right, so this is a cut and paste of what Jeff Bridges says. Where there is a hilarious 5-minute scene in the movie where he has to give an answer and he's trying to escape in all directions and it's completely messy. So that, don't do that. Okay, I mean, see the movie and see what you should not do. And it's very funny too. All right, what happens if there are no questions? Okay, and that actually happens. So you gave a talk and you didn't warm up the audience, or they are completely flabbergasted, or they are tired, or they are whatever. But so if you have a computer demo, you remind people about it. You can say thank you and pack up your slides. Or you can be brilliant, like that PhD student I saw at TLCA 2001 in Warsaw, Poland. He said, good, then let me show you a couple more slides. And he put his slides, and then he gave them, and that woke up the audience who had questions, so we ran our time. So again, you can, yes, Dan.
One other idea might be to say, well, a question that, you know, when I was giving this talk somewhere else, an interesting question came up that you might.
That kind of hints that you recycle.
You just need to repeat that.
So it's double-edged. What you can say.
There was a student yesterday who asked me, or in the conference, or anything to kind of keep the spirit of the community closed. All right, you should give honest answers. So Harry Seldon is the psychohistorian of Foundation, the historical trilogy by Isaac Asimov. And then there has been a spin-off called Foundation's Friends, in which a bunch of very, very good science fiction writers wrote a little short story placed in the Foundation universe. And in one of these stories, there is Harry Seldon, who is attending a conference. And he can see that the speaker is on the wrong track. So he raises his hand, and then he makes a point. And then he sits down, and he leaves it at that. And his friends ask him, but what, you could have crucified him. He was so wrong. And what Harry Seldon says is, well, I made my point up, and then he was at the point where he realized that he was wrong. And then I let him go, and it's up to him to be honest with himself. So you usually do not want to have this kind of aggression where you should always leave an escape exit unless you want to fight to the death, and why should you? So if someone does that to you, it's nice not to have a fight to the death where you're completely ridiculed because maybe you didn't see something. So it's all about scientific honesty, and giving an honest answer is just the right thing to do. A little word about plagiarism, which is you only test whether you're honest or your virtue until you meet temptation. And unless the day you meet a temptation, you have no idea how your virtue is. So example, plagiarism. Of course you will not plagiarize. But then there will be one day where you're tired or it's just such a good idea or blah, blah, blah. And then it will you will be tempted, and it's that day that you will discover yourself. So again, the world is not like Dilbert. It's not the others that are idiots or that are weak or that blah, blah, blah. It's us. It's me, each of us. Okay, so now you're at the end of the talk. You have had zillion questions. And what happens afterwards? So if you are in a conference, there is a session break. There is the next meal. There is after hours, and there is after the conference. And there is one rule, which is make yourself visible and be ready for more questions. You're here to participate, see people, interact, mingle, talk. At the next meal, do not make separate lunch or dinner plans. Go with the people who are in the conference and be available for discussions, or initiate discussions yourself. And after hours, be available for discussions. Your advisor pays money for you to come here. Make sure that you talk shop as much as possible. After the conference, you receive a mail. Promptly acknowledge a good receipt of the mail. And if it's about the work and you have co-authors, check with them. Again, you're not just representing yourself, you're representing your co-authors. And that matters for the following reason. At one point in your PhD studies, your mind will be like a supersaturated media, ready to change state, but except that it has not changed state. And anything can make you just change state. And that anything can just be someone making a remark, which you forget. And then X weeks / month afterwards, you receive that furious email by that guy who says, "Your paper is what I told you at that conference." And then you have a mess on your hands. So to fix that, just keep a log of what's happening, whom you talk to, and blah, blah, blah. And then you can say honestly, look, this is what my log said. I talked with blah, we said blah. I'm sorry, look, this is the evidence that I have. Okay, and the said situation is likely to arrive to you because everybody is kind of on their toes so example, how continuations were invented. Well, Christopher Wadsworth was thinking very long and hard about how to model Gutus in a functional language. His advisor, Christopher Strachey, arrives and says, "Hey, I was at a conference and I heard about tail functions." And that tail function was just the idea that Christopher Wadsworth needed. Tail function, of course, what happens afterwards? That's going to be the denotation, the thing that continues. Actually, a better name is continuations, and then right, so there is no connection between the content of the paper on tail functions and Christopher Wadsworth's discovery. And yet, would he have had it? Because so your mind is a super saturated state. Keep notes, remember who told what to whom. All right? Now, symmetrically, all the concerns that I told you about giving a talk apply the other way around. So when you receive a talk, be prepared. A good participant has read the proceedings the evening before. And go and talk shop with the authors because they came here for that. All right, here is a bunch of tips for you graduate student guys at conferences. Don't hope that someone important will just be there for you. Okay, he's a busy guy. He has lots of colleagues to talk to. On the other hand, you can surf. You can surf on the wave and observe that professors love to talk. So a good thing to ask them is ask them to tell them about their research. And there is that unknown theorem that says that even if they are busy, professors will tell you about their research. So use that. This is your opening thing. In the US, professors tell you about their research. It's never about what they are doing now. It's always about the last paper that they have published. It's not true in Europe. I'm just telling you. Okay, so here is a tip for any Indian students that you may know who applies for an internship. Dear sir/madam, this is the end. You can see here, send it to 10,000 places. If you apply anywhere, you should personalize your application letters. And you write, less is more. I mean, if it's a given that if you write to anyone who is in academia and who talked, you tell him about, "Hey, I have read 3 of your last papers, and I was interested because blah, 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 and I have some questions." is going to find funding to invite you. There is no question there. And why? Because you have specialized the application letter for him. So it, the same works for talking with people. Okay, so your sanity check is in a note, in a conference where lots of things happen. Keep notes about who's who and who's you've talked to and what you have said and what you were told. That could be very, very helpful down the line. All right? One day, sooner than you think, you will be asked to chair a session. So here are some tips. You should meet all the speakers prior to your session. You should agree with them about the signals, 5 minutes, 1 minute, stop. You should make sure that the speaker sees your signal. In the worst case, you should get up and come next to him. You should act as the moderator for the questions. And then you should be kind and have a couple of questions ready in case there are no other questions. It's very often that the PhD student is there, give his first talk, he's stressed, does do a not quite optimal job, but he does it. The session chair looks at the audience and say, are there any questions? And everybody just put their nose in their proceedings, saying, oh my gosh, I don't have any questions. And the student is crushed. As a good session chair, you should say, good, I have a question. And then see how the student beaming with happiness because, someone is interested in what I do. Okay, so I've done that in the past. That what it cost me was to serve on the program, on the PhD committee of the guy, because clearly I knew so much about his research. So it's double-edged. Great cities anyway. But the point about having questions ready will be a kind thing, and it will often start interesting discussions. All right, if you ever run parallel sessions on time, keep them on time. People depend on you to change track, to go from one amphitheater to the other. So you owe it to them, and you have to be ruthless. All right? So in conclusion, all of these are just guidelines. You should suit them to your needs. Of course, you should do what I said, not what I did here. Make sure you write a comic strip before your talk. Make sure to remember to breathe during your talk. That will keep you going. And make sure to repeat each question after your talk. OK? I'll be happy to take some questions now. If there are no questions, I can tell you about the care and feeding of your PhD supervisor, which is kind of nice to know. Dan.
What's the advantage
of
slides?
Do
you use PowerPoint or Beamer?
DVI, because I'm a quick hack. When I need more sophistication, I use Beamer in Linux. It's very practical.
I've been using Beamer for a while, and I just started switching to Keynote.
A lot of people say
so find something that works for you, but that's the bottom line. But write your slides first by hand because you do not become prisoner of the format, which happens too often. Other questions? Of your PhD supervisor. Your PhD supervisor is someone who is important in your life. Okay, you're going to be with that person for a small but important number of years. It's your formative years. You're going to change during that. Once you have departed, he will be asked to write recommendation letters for you for the next X years of your life. Okay, so he's a really important person for you, for what happens, whom you become, and what happens afterwards. I say he generically because there are so few female supervisors, so I just say he generically. He's a busy person, like he has other PhD students. Okay? So how do you manage to deal with that? Well, it's a little bit the same as for the Indian intern who is or a student who is seeking an internship. Your professor or your supervisor is someone whose sort of life is research. This is probably what, if he took you, it's because he likes something in research. So you need to get to know him. And you need to ultimately have some kind of intellectual communion between him and you. You should be able to talk and each of you understand. So there is a simple recipe for getting there. And you have to do the first step because he's busy, right? You have a lot more time than him, relatively speaking. So there is a very simple thing to do. Read his papers and see what kind of person he is through his writing. And if you can put your hands on his PhD thesis, do it. Because that's what he did when he was your age. So in doing so, you will learn to know him in a rather substantial way that is going to be useful for your research and for your interaction with him. You should kind of know, well, how he operates, and you should try to optimize that you should try to optimize your interaction with him. So you see him writing a paper, propose to proofread that if he doesn't ask you. Anything that would make him spend a little more time with you is a good thing. It's usually a good idea to socialize with him because you see what kind of person he is, and he's going to influence you. So, for example, he's going to influence you in ways you have no idea. So, like Neil Jones, who was he is retired now. He was a professor at the University of Copenhagen. He actually managed to shape the handwriting of some of his PhD students. I personally knew a master's student who started with Neil. And by the end of his PhD studies, you could see that his handwriting, all caps, on the blackboard or on pieces of paper, were like Neil. So this is an extreme example, but he's going to influence you in ways that you do not realize right now. Another good thing that you should do is to read the thesis that he has supervised. Because that's another example of things he has done before you. And you should see what you like in them and see how he interacts with you and blah, blah, blah. Okay? So, in short, you should try to become an asset for him the way he's, or at least a little bit like the way he's a huge asset for you. So, keep in mind that he has a lot of other students, he has many responsibilities, is often tired and blah, blah, blah. And you have to operate with him anyway. And so the only way to get through his heart and his brain is read his former papers, his thesis, see what he has supervised, and then he will talk about the things that excites him the most in life, which is his research. And once you have done that, then naturally things will kind of feed back to you. Okay, and that's very, very simple advice, but it really will get you a long, long way. As for in some kind of similar way, meeting that big professor in a conference and get him to talk to you, I would like to share with you the finding of Christopher Rose, who is working at IBM T.J. Watson, and he was Neil Jones' PhD student, and he has developed XYPIC, which is a graphics package in LaTeX to write categorical diagram. So Christopher's thesis was about circular graph rewriting. Never mind what it is. Some people are excited about it. So he wanted to go and talk with big shots in his area. Well, they were all busy talking to each other. So what he did was to write a few diagrams that he had found in their paper or something in XYPIC. And then he arrived and say, look. Then the professor would look at them, oh, that's cool. I could use that. That's a package that I made. It's called XYPIC. And you can draw this and that. Ah, this is really nice. And then the professor is like, oh, I could use this, I could use this, I could use this. And then he swap another one, say, ah, this is a really nice diagram. Oh, yeah, what is it? Well, it's about my PhD thesis. And now we can talk about it. And the guy is really interested. So you got him by where he was interested, and you end up talking about your thesis. Okay, it has been done. You shouldn't try to write a LaTeX package to print a thing. Find your own thing, okay? But you kind of have to break the barrier of being busy and being, you know, saturated with information and blah, blah, blah. And your goal is to establish that level, that area of intellectual communion where you communicate intellectually. And then keep in mind that you are going to grow with that person, is going to impress you in the sense of print. And once you move on in life, people say, oh, yeah, he's your student. Or, yeah, that guy, he was X's student. And that's just a fact. So So accept it, and then move on with it. Okay? All right? Any questions?
Suppose that you have met a professor right now, and you haven't read any of his paper, and you haven't even looked at his webpage. What is the polite way to ask about his research? I mean, most of the time people just say that you can look at my papers, but you just want to have a summary idea of what he's doing.
You're in a difficult position. I'm afraid you have to make the first move. And you yourself, look what he has done, if you want that to work. I mean, you meet John McCarthy or John Reynolds, and then you say, I don't know, I'm thinking of the gods. Okay. You meet Patrick and say, what are you doing? I mean, how can you say that? It's Mr. Abstract Interpretation. Of course you have to know that.
But suppose you attend the talk.
Yeah.
You gave the talk to someone, and you just want to...
Basic pedagogy, Aristotle. Pedagogy is to take people where they are, to lead them where they want to go. You first have to find a common ground, and then you can move it. So that was an interesting talk you made. I'm wondering if, or there is something that I didn't understand, or would. Okay, and now you have started to talk. Okay. Yes. I'm sorry, I forgot to repeat your question.
Is there anything to watch out for an advisor, to be careful about?
That can go wrong with your supervisor. That's a really difficult question. What could go wrong with your supervisor? When you're young, there is no way you can understand. I mean, you can even assess that. Karate Kid. Have you seen that movie? The Karate Kid. So it's a cute movie about kung fu and old guy, very wise. And thank you. All right. Well, at the beginning of the movie, the advisor asks the guy to do stuff which he finds revolting. And then after a while, he realized that these things were actually useful. So, and he seriously doubted the sanity of his sensei. So if there are things like that, that you do not understand with your supervisor, you can always mention that. I don't understand why you want me to do that, but I trust you because you're my supervisor. I'll probably know better, but look, I'm not understanding why you ask me to do that. That's the best that you can do. But there are lots of things that I know a lot of people. Okay, your supervisor is not your dad. If you have any kind of unresolved conflict, Freudian conflict with your dad, they are not good to transfer to your supervisor. I'm not saying that for you, but I've seen it so many times of reproaches that are disguised criticisms that reflect insecurities. I mean, all of that needs to be kind of flushed out of your relation. Your relation is primarily scientific. If you have concerns about that professor, they should be scientific. If you have scientific concern about his, you should talk about it and maybe switch supervisor. But do not let personal issue pollute that relation. And unfortunately, I've seen it done several times. I've seen people who are sky-high clever who just spend their whole life fighting each other for what? All the good science they didn't do because they were fighting. So give credit to your professor, to summarize. He may be doing something for a good reason that you do not know, like the sensei in Karate Kid. Two, if you have concerns that are exclusively scientific, manifest them. Say, I don't understand why you want me to do that, but you're my sensei, I'll do it. And if they are personal, well, I'm sure that there is you can talk with. This is why you should have talked with his former students. You should have seen the thesis he supervised. You should have, okay. But by default, give him credit for a lot because he's busy for lots of reasons. So the things to watch out are well, I don't know, is he late for appointments? Does he not read what you say? Is he that kind of things? Or is it, does he ask you to do something that you don't want to do? Like what?
Well, I wouldn't say
just in general.
You
in general, yeah.
Well, I mean, just is there anything to look out for? Is there anything, if there's something wrong that he could be doing, is there anything we should look out to see if he's doing that?
Being precise, is it in your working relation with him? Is it about an ethics question? I mean, the SEM has guidelines about ethics. If you think that your supervisor is embezzling money, or if you disagree that he's trying to make anti-personal mines for I don't know which country. You know, it's very wide what you say.
For like choosing an advisor, I'm just wondering.
Okay, so choosing an advisor, you should
read the papers that he has written, see the thesis that he has supervised before, check his level of availability. So like, if he's just an assistant professor, and his number one goal in life is to get his tenure, well, then his number one goal in life is to get his tenure, not to supervise you. So anything that you will do with him should help him to get his tenure if you want his attention. Okay, so that's an example. There, to choose a supervisor, you have to kind of to take all of these accounts, but the best is experience. Look, his former students, his own research, his former students, and how available is he is. If he's a super busy guy, but he has a great research environment, which you could surf on, that's okay. If he's barely making it and he's still fighting for his tenure and it's not clear he's going to get it, he's not going to spend so much quality time with you. And his worries are not going to be you, they are going to be his position. So that's just common sense. Am I answering your question?
Yeah.
So from your point of view, again, see what he has done before. What are his credentials? How good a supervisor he is, how good a scientist he is, how good a mentor he is, how good a teacher he is. And then you decide. It's a delicate question. All right, other questions? Delicate or not? Please.
Thank you.